You know how important this 101 series is to me for the really big issues that I think that midlife women go through. And today is a big one on that list. We are talking about dementia and memory issues and cognitive disease and all the kinds of things that if we're not dealing with it now, there's a good chance it's going to be part of our lives in the future. I'm speaking today with a gerontologist educator, and this is education, right? It's for entertainment purposes and educational purposes only, but I promise you're going to learn a lot, even if you're kind of in the throes of living with someone with dementia or another cognitive disease now. I hope today's episode brings some insights, some actions, and some hope. Welcome to Surfing the Quicksand. I'm your host, Kathy Vines. You know, it's been important to me to bring a number of really critical conversations to the Surfing the Quicksand audience. And today is a big one for me. And if it's something that's not impacting you now, it might impact you in the future. Actually, probably odds are it will in some way. My guest today is Donna Fettes. She's a gerontologist, educator, and advocate, and has spent more than 3 decades working with people to help better understand aging, dementia, caregiving. Much of it through her business, Borrow My Glasses. And we're going to talk about the name there, Borrow My Glasses. But much through her business, she works with universities and hospitals and organizations and families to help better understand the aging process with compassion and all of the challenges that come with that. She is rooted in research and real human connection, and she is deeply committed to help people better navigate this universal part of life, which can really be overwhelming, and do it in a way that maybe doesn't feel always like it's a tragedy. Welcome, Donna.
Thanks, Kathy. I really appreciate this conversation that you're bringing to the world.
I'm someone who, I'm open about, I'm an adult who's very involved with, we actually have 4 sets of parents still alive between my husband and me, which is not very common for people in their mid-50s, but we know that it means we've got people in their 80s and we're always paying attention to what's going on and we wonder about what's coming. Working with dementia and other issues are not really on our table right now, and we feel fortunate for that. But we always know that kind of the numbers are. We're going to start seeing more and more memory issues and cognitive issues as they continue to age. So that's why it's always on my mind to learn more. But I know as I talk with people who are part of the Surfing the Quicksand audience, it is and has been a big part of a lot of people's lives. I want to talk first with you just about you and who you are, what you do, what a gerontologist is, so that people know what the next hour is going to be about.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I'm actually glad you're starting with that because so many people think I'm a physician when I say I'm a gerontologist and I'm not. So I want to clear that up straight away. I'm master's trained and I'm an expert in aging. That's a gerontologist. If I were an expert in aging and a physician, I'd be a geriatrician. So pediatrician is a doctor for kids, geriatrician is a doctor for older adults. And a non-clinical expert in aging is a gerontologist. That's what I do. The other thing that I'm glad that you sort of mentioned is I'm a gerontologist educator because that's how I've chosen to focus my career. You can have a gerontology degree and focus in advocacy work and work in policy or financial gerontologist or any other, kind of gerontologist. For me, education is really, it's really that intersection between aging, caregiving dementia, and education is where I have found my sweet spot.
I love that. I think geriatrician is a word I've never heard before. I'm quite confident of it. So I'm glad they even brought it up. So if I ever stumble across one, I'll be like, oh, wait, I know what that is.
No, absolutely. And it's helpful to know, for people, for caregiver family caregivers, because to look up resources, to understand, what you're looking for, it's a good term to know about.
You just mentioned caregivers and then corrected by saying family caregivers. Let's start there because I do think that caregiving is a really broad term. When you think about caregivers, especially from a point of view of who you work with and what you do with them, can you walk us a little bit through some of that language?
Right, another term that really we should discuss because people are confused about that one as well. So when I talk about caregivers, for me, that is a broad term, and I usually do try to qualify it as either family caregivers or professional caregivers. So family caregivers, in the field, that tends to be your family members. It could be family of choice. It could be actually your neighbors or friends could also be considered family caregivers. When we as professionals think about that. So a family caregiver traditionally is someone who's not paid. We consider them informal caregivers. That's another term you might hear. And there are people who care about that older adult. And it doesn't have to be the person living with them. You can be a long distance family caregiver, and that would be technically more than 1 hour away or states away or countries away. But all of those family caregivers are really the backbone of our long-term care, system in this country. More than 80% of all care is provided by informal family caregivers. Some of them are paid now in certain states, so that's kind of a newer way to support caregivers to do the work of it, which is very intense for people. But traditionally, they're unpaid. Contrasting that with professional caregivers, and often when we use that term, it's frontline workers. So it would be your CNAs, your PCAs, if they're in a home care setting or, nursing home, hospital, whatever it might be, senior living, actually, also. So those are professional caregivers. As you go up the chain in terms of healthcare workers, we don't usually refer to those people as caregivers if they have a title like nurse, social worker, physical therapist, doctor, that kind of thing. But frontline workers professionally are caregivers as opposed to family caregivers. So.
That's great. And I'm thinking I described that we have, our four parents are still around, and my parents are in a senior living facility, but an independent living, but it's a mixed facility. So they're certainly exposed to assisted living and memory care. And then my mother-in-law has been in a skilled nursing facility for some time, and my father-in-law lives independently, but with a lot of support from family near and far. And so I think we have a little bit of the gamut amongst all that.
Right. And
Yeah.
that's a great explanation of that continuum,
Yeah.
especially in senior living.
Yeah. So I want to talk about kind of the meat of the topic for today, really around memory and cognitive issues. And I think listen, I'm 55 and I can walk in a room and completely forget why I'm there. And if I think I'm going to do something, if I don't immediately write it down, it is gone. Like I can forget something between thinking about it and grabbing my phone to type it down, right? So I think memory issues can be a function of overwhelmed life, inspire all sorts of different things. But there's a difference between you're living an overwhelmed life and there are medical issues going on, or there are real kind of physiological issues going on. Can you start to walk us through that? I know that dementia and Alzheimer's are two big words that get used a lot. I know there's an overlap. I don't know what that is, where those things start and where those stop. I know cognitive impairness is part of this. What's the breadth of what we're talking about?
Such a great question. I really appreciate your learning about it and trying to separate all these strands, right? There's a tapestry and a picture that people have, and we really need to pull these apart to understand each of them a little bit more. So why don't we start with terms? I think that's probably a good place to start. People, their cognition changes over time. That's part of normal aging. I'm 60 and I have the same experiences that you do. I'm like, why did I come into this room? Where did I park my car? All of that. What is that person's name that's walking towards me in the grocery store? For someone I haven't seen in a while. So I'm sure many of your listeners can relate to this because it's normal aging. And it does make it a little bit harder to talk about these things because we can all universally expect to experience some normal age-related forgetfulness, right? So when does it go beyond normal and turn into an indicator of something that you might want to explore further that might be, a potential issue? And I think that's kind of that line that you're talking about there. So we'll all expect to have these moments of memory loss or word finding challenges or, why did I come into this room type of a thing. But if you can then remember, that's usually a very good sign, right? Sometimes it's when you calm down, when you get all flustered about it, it can be really harder to remember. And when you settle, it's like, oh, I know that person's name now. That is usually a good sign. So if it pops back into your mind, that's a good thing. If you're really trying to remember something and you can't, it really you've lost sort of all context for it, that's more concerning, right? If based on who you are and your lived experience in the world, if it's different from your baseline, that's more concerning. So if if my checkbook isn't balanced, that's not super concerning. It's not super surprising, right? It's not a job I do too often. But for an accountant who doesn't have a balanced checkbook, that would be very concerning. Or for that person who's super organized or really on top of, the details of their life to have unpaid bills, that's really concerning because it's different from their norm. So that's part of it. What's your baseline and how far off that are you? That can indicate something going on. The other thing that I'm wanting to highlight is that it can go beyond memory. I know people think memory loss is the main issue with cognitive disease, and it's certainly a key issue, but it's not the only one. So if people have issues with thinking, planning, judgment, reasoning, kind of logicking out a situation, that when they were able to do those things before, that's really concerning as well. So it can expand beyond memory loss. So it's a little bit about intensity, right? It's a little bit about is it different from who you've been your whole life? It's a little bit about being extreme. How extreme is the example? For instance, if you forget where you put your keys, that's not super concerning if it happens occasionally and then you find them. But it's more concerning if you lose them and really can't figure out how to retrace your steps or how to get another set, or how to work it out. Or you find them in the freezer, that's sort of the classic example, right? So how extreme is it? How frequent is it? Is it impacting your daily functioning? That's another way to think about it. So those are some ways, that people can kind of wrap their mind around that. So is it normal aging? Is it something more concerning? And if it's something more concerning, there are a lot of ways you can then explore that. And I guess I would really want people to think, don't automatically think it's Alzheimer's. It may be or it may not be. And so getting that checked out and evaluated is really important because there's a whole series of things that can cause literally dementia symptoms, but they come from reversible causes. And if you figure out what those are and reverse them, those symptoms will disappear. So those things that can cause is I don't know if this is familiar. I'm happy to
Yeah,
go on.
no. I mean, you start talking about that, and the first thing that comes to my mind is a UTI, right?
Correct.
Urinary
That's
tract
one.
just to, urinary tract infection. It's the one thing I hear anytime. Go back a second. When you started talking about, and I appreciate you kind of redirecting around. It's not just about memory; it can be about a lot of different things. And the phrase that came to my mind was like, "Oh, she's just not herself." Right. Oh, she's right. And that becomes the, oh, it's not just memory. It's like, oh, they used to be good at this. Oh, she never used to. Oh, that's weird. What's going on with her filter? Whatever it is, she's just not herself. And when I think about, oh, you can start seeing she's just not herself. And the answer is, did you get her checked for a UTI? Like that it's become a lot more about, hearing hoofs. I don't know. I forget this, don't think horse, not zebra, but like it's often like, oh, let's start with UTI.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thought. It sounds like you've been down that road
Yeah.
before.
Yeah. And honestly, my first exposure to it was really as a professional organizer. And, I've been in that space for 13 years and working with older people. And I could work with somebody and be like, oh, why is today really different? And learning, kind of like, oh, I'll hear later, oh my gosh, I was in the hospital, I had a UTI. And I'm like, oh, now I know. Like that was my exposure to it initially.
And to know then, to have it checked out and hopefully treated, then the person returns to their baseline. So if they didn't have Alzheimer's or another kind of dementia previously, They'd return to kind of their normal. Even if they have Alzheimer's or dementia, they have that diagnosis and they have a UTI, it can seem a lot more intense. It can, cause a lot more agitation and upset and being not their usual selves, you know? And so if you clear it up, they come back to their normal. So absolutely.
Good. Now we've used dementia and Alzheimer's, those terms so far. Can you put some context around those two and the overlap and the differences?
Yep, absolutely. So I can. And Alzheimer's is basically the most common cause of dementia symptoms. So that's why we talk about it sometimes interchangeably, even though it's really not. Dementia is your broader umbrella term for a whole range of symptoms. And that can be memory loss. That's usually something that's seen pretty often. It can be those problems with thinking, judgment, reasoning, planning. It can be confusion about space and time. You can be a time traveler a little bit in terms of being much more familiar with the long-term memory, things that happened a long time ago, and much more confused about things that are happening kind of here and now in the short-term memory. So that orientation, it can be verbally. People can have something called aphasia, right? So it can be receptive aphasia, where people have trouble understanding language is coming at them. Or expressive aphasia, where people have trouble communicating verbally. Doesn't happen to everybody, but it does happen to some. So there's a whole range of symptoms. And when you have those symptoms, you have dementia. The next question is, what's causing those symptoms? And that's where the evaluation comes in. And there can be testing. And then most often, Alzheimer's disease is going to be the cause of those symptoms, but not always. There can be other things that cause dementia symptoms. So Lewy body dementia is one. Frontotemporal dementia is one. Vascular dementia is one. And each of those are the other most common causes. And depending on which one it is, that would indicate what changes are going on in that person's brain, right? So it can vary. Unfortunately, you can also have mixed type dementia, which means you literally have more than one disease process going on in your brain. So you can have the plaques and tangles that are associated with Alzheimer's disease, right? And maybe you're having strokes, which is the most common cause of vascular dementia, interruption of blood to the brain. So if people have Parkinson's, they're more likely to have dementia with Lewy bodies, that type. People who are younger are more at risk for frontotemporal dementia. So there's all kinds of things that are going on, and those are just the top. There are dozens of potential causes of dementia symptoms. So knowing which one it is important. And as I was mentioning, knowing if it's reversible dementia is also important because if possible, you want to reverse those symptoms. So you said UTI, right? That's one of the causes of or top, yeah, causes of reversible dementia. People should also know medication interaction is a big cause of dementia symptoms. A thyroid condition left untreated for long enough can give you those kinds of symptoms. Dehydration, a UTI is one, but any kind of infection left untreated and so on. So there's a lot of reason to really explore when people are off their normal to the point that it's interfering with their daily functioning or they're having trouble in their life.
You mentioned a couple of different dimensions, and vascular, I understand, is kind of the vascular system in your body, and blood, how's blood traveling? You mentioned plaques and tangles, and I want to talk a little bit about that. You mentioned Lewy body, and I feel like that's the one that gets is a little bit more in the vernacular because is that what Bruce Willis has? Right. So I think for a lot of people, maybe that's the first they're hearing or seeing of that. Can you explain, like, literally what Lewy body is?
Yeah, Lewy body dementia. It's protein deposits, and they can be kind of all over the brain. Name for the scientist who found them. So the part of the brain that's impacted would really explain what trouble the person is having functionally in their life, right? With Alzheimer's disease, it starts in the hippocampus, which is here, like on the sides of your brain. The hippocampus does a few things, but one of the key things is it helps you to learn new things and retain them, which is why short-term memory loss is often the first kinds of symptoms that we see when somebody has Alzheimer's disease. And as, for instance, Alzheimer's will progress throughout the brain, it gets worse here, which is why your short-term memory gets worse and worse and worse as time goes on. And then it kind of expands up and it expands back and around. Knowing that progression, even though people go through it at their own pace, it can really help you to get clearer about where you can connect with people. For instance, their emotions are going to be intact largely for the entire disease, and understanding the emotions that someone is feeling when they have Alzheimer's disease, that's really helpful to know. You know, versus Lewy body, it can be anywhere in the brain versus vascular dementia. It depends on where that interruption of blood is flowing to the brain. That part of the brain, whatever that controls, that's where they're going to have trouble. So, there's a lot more to it, but that just gives people a way to think about it. And again, why it is helpful to have a diagnosis and to understand to the extent you can what type you have.
Well, what I love most about what you just kind of talked about, well, first of all, your brain is such a complex piece of real estate, and how whatever disease is showing up for you and where it's showing up is going to impact the journey that that patient and caregivers therefore are on. But also the idea of it lets you know, so what is still working, or what is the way that you can connect with these people? And everybody, not no two people are going to have the same journey, but you can't just assume that so and so's mother had this issue, so and so's uncle had this issue, therefore my experience is going to be the same, right? It really kind of implores the idea of understand and learn more about what the your loved one is going through, so that you can figure out what's reversible, how are they reachable, what's the silver lining or the positives in the journey ahead that you can influence.
Yeah, I love that. And again, you're bringing up so many important issues there. So to pull that apart a little bit, recognizing as we've been talking about, it will be different. We have this saying in the work, you probably heard this before, if you know one person with dementia, you know one person with dementia. So, it's figuring out that individual. And there are generalities in terms of their diagnosis and the process they're going to go through, but everyone goes through that in an idiosyncratic way, in their own individual way, in terms of pace, in terms of exactly what it looks like. And if you have had a lifetime of experience, what we call building cognitive reserve, which means building up a lot of brain cells and strengthening the pathways between those brain cells, you can withstand more damage to that area of your brain before you're going to exhibit symptoms. And so for people who, have certain strengths, they're going to continue to do those for longer. It's also, really hopeful because when you start earlier with brain health and brain fitness strategies and build and build and build that cognitive reserve, it means you can withstand, damage longer from Alzheimer's or other kinds of dementia, even from an injury. It's kind of exciting research going on in cognitive reserve and brain health.
I was
But
just want to say, like, it's funny that as you're talking, I'm thinking like, oh, this feels like brain health. And you mentioned brain health. And I said, oh, that's why there's like brain games and brain things that you can do. And I hadn't really put it together that the purpose of doing that is just like, let's make this, I won't use the term muscle because it's not a muscle, but let's make this quote muscle as strong as it can be so that as things are coming its way, it can continue to like hold the breach.
yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. And we can talk, I mean, I do whole workshops on all these things. So we're just giving snippets though of these. But
Absolutely.
that is absolutely the concept, right? And so we understand physical fitness and how we build strength and muscle and all of that. It brain fitness works the same way just for your brain. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I want to talk also about just mild cognitive impairedness, which is another term I've heard. And can you put that in context to what we've already been talking about?
Sure. So mild cognitive impairment is technically a preclinical state. It means something is changing. Excuse me. Something is changing in your cognition. It's starting to impact daily functioning in some way, but it's not enough to give you a diagnosis of, some kind of Alzheimer's disease or whatever it might be. Many people who are in that MCI, mild cognitive impairment realm, will go on at some point to get, have more damage and enough to get a diagnosis, but not all do. And so it's just something that you're watching, you're monitoring a little more closely. Brain fitness is great for anyone, even if you have a diagnosis, but for sure with MCI, there's, to do more and more for your physical health and your brain health is a good idea.
Great. I think I cut you off before, and I'm hoping your memory is good enough to go back to what it was.
Yeah. Well, you had asked me a great question, which I loved, which is really how do you keep connecting, right?
Yes.
So even when someone has Alzheimer's or another kind of dementia, and that means there's a disease process, it's in their brain, it is going to be degenerative, meaning it's going to, continue on. For many of these, we really don't have cures at this point. There are a couple new meds out there that are disease modifying medications. So hopefully there'll be more options in the future. But what do? How do you continue to support that person? How do you continue to connect with that individual? And there are many, many, many ways. And I feel like this is, it's just something I would love for people to understand that a diagnosis like this doesn't mean the end of your life ASAP. This is a long pathway, right? People can have Alzheimer's 8 to 12 years on average, but it can be as long as 20 years that people are living with this. And you can continue to connect with that individual throughout that whole entire time, as long as you know how. And that would be customized based on what their actual illness is. Who they are as a person. You can come up with very specific activities and ways to connect with them. Understanding their emotions is that's going to be something that you can connect on. Music is usually something, anything arts related that doesn't require memory. I mean, there's lots and lots and lots to say. But I think the big thing is knowing that people with cognitive disease are still people and they're still here. And there are many ways to connect with that individual.
It is so overwhelming, I'm sure, to people who are in the throes of this disease, and I don't just mean the individual, the loved one, but their caregivers as well. Where I imagine that patience ending with CE is kind of like the biggest virtue, because when you say it can be 8 to 12 years or it can be 20 years, that feels like a lot for people to say. I'm gonna be doing some heavy lifting in a lot of ways for a long journey. I almost don't even know what I want to say after that, but it just really struck me when you said it can be 20 years. Like, wow, on one hand, that feels like really, really promising. Like, oh my gosh, this is not an end of life statement. But on the other hand, for somebody who feels like, oh, I only see what's coming, feels negative, this can be a lot for people.
Right, that's fair. And it's even though in my work I'm often highlighting the positive and teaching people skills, healthcare professionals and family caregivers, teaching people skills in terms of how to connect, how to understand, how to walk through, this illness with your person and support them and really find ways to support yourself because you're going to need that as well, especially for more of a marathon, than a sprint kind of an experience. But I think, like so many things, the more you learn about it, the less overwhelming it can be. The more skilled you are, the less thrown off you are. And there's actually research to back that up. There's a researcher named Mary Mittleman. She's at NYU, and her research is emblematic of this. But she found that if she could train caregivers and support caregivers along the way, they could maintain their person at home for years longer, right? And that if they wanted to, there's and if they were able to do that. But from a skills point of view, they were able to do it. And it just that's just one. There's many more research studies that are kind of showing that. So to help people understand how to do it, it does feel a little bit less overwhelming. But so many family caregivers don't reach out. There's a lot of stigma, about cognitive illness and especially about dementia, very unfortunately. I don't know if you've heard about this in your world or experienced it. People fall away. When someone has Alzheimer's and they're repeating things, or they're responding to something in a socially inappropriate way. People don't have the skills to know how to handle that. And it's like, oh, better back up now. And that's the last thing that you do, because then those primary caregivers, in the family, the ones that have the capacity or don't, but by default, they're like the one that lives closest, or it somehow fell to them in the family, can get very, very overwhelmed. So I'm not saying it's easy. I feel like the more you learn and the more you seek support and information, the easier it gets and the more confident and comfortable you will be.
I think about those kind of those stories, my own life, again, friends that we share, and that you just mentioned that one, right? Like, oh, they're repeating stories. We've heard this one before. They're repeating stories. And it can't be like that, that the nails on the chalkboard, that beginning of things like this in of itself isn't such an awful thing. But boy, when it's my whole life, or when it feels constant, or it feels like we just had this conversation 10 minutes ago and they're on a loop, it can be that part that erodes away. Can we talk about some of the kind of the most common, again, when you meet one person with dementia, meet one person with dementia, I get that. But some of the most common behaviors or experiences that you hear people struggling with. I'm talking about the caregivers struggling.
No, that's one. Repeat, and we know that because short-term memory is going to be a symptom of this illness. So that is to be expected. It doesn't always make it easier just knowing that. It might make it somewhat easier, but it's really very frustrating. I think there's a couple of things to say. So when your person is repeating and repeating and repeating, what can you do about that? One is not to be correcting them and not to be interrupting them if you can help it. Not to challenge their reality of something. Really listening is the best thing that you can do, and it will pass that much faster if you just listen. Even if a person doesn't have dementia of any kind, when we all reach that last stage of our life, Erik Erikson said that one of our developmental stages that we go through, like we went through as babies and kids and all through our life, that a developmental stage of aging is to do something called life review, where you're thinking back over the course of your life and understanding, why was I here? What was the purpose of my life? Did I fulfill what I think my purpose is? What's it all about? The meaning? What am I leaving for future generations? That kind of generativity and so on. And so in doing that life review process, a lot of older people repeat their stories, right? And so it is a gift to witness that and to just listen. And that's something that you can do. So knowing you're doing something very important might make it a little bit easier. If the person has dementia, they're not going to remember that they've said it. And so there's that. You had no question, but I have other strategies, but go ahead. What
Yeah,
was your
no. I was recalling somebody that I worked with again in an organizing capability where he had Parkinson's, and they were in the process of moving, and the family basically said, all he's doing is telling stories, and we just can't anymore. We don't have the space. They don't have the emotional, mental space anymore. And so I was really that. Yes, we were going through his stuff, but I really felt my value was there, was to receive that processing and those stories. And it was done through stuff, like stuff as the vehicle for storytelling. But clearly, that was a phase that I could see now that he was really in.
Yeah, you were helping with that. And so an organizer, a senior move manager is playing a very valuable part. That's a specialty that people might not know about. I refer, to those kinds of professionals like yourself, because it is such a valuable service. For me, when the family caregivers have kind of had enough, on any given day, okay, that's reasonable. Having thought about activities to switch into and maybe distract or divert the person into something else, and thinking ahead of time before you're super frustrated, and having those go-to activities, that can be one strategy. Respite or having a break can also be a strategy. So it can be an indicator when a caregiver is continually sort of reaching the end of their rope with that kind of thing, that might be telling you need a different balance. You need a break yourself. You need more people to be involved to help. Maybe there's a community-based program or home care. help that you can get in the home to give yourself a break. So sometimes it's an indicator of a larger need that a caregiver has that they're not recognizing. Sometimes that can be accomplished by, all those people that say, just let me know if I can help. Have something ready for them to do. You know, it would be great if you want to come have lunch with so and so, and I'll have an hour to myself or whatever. Or so there's a lot of ways for caregivers to be thinking about how to broaden their care circle, is sometimes how I think about that, with informal help, family, friends, neighbors, faith community, right? Those kinds of people. Or that might be an indicator that a different living arrangement is necessary. And maybe that is something that you want to take on, or more help in the home, paid help, you know? So respite, getting a break, having more skills, having something else to divert to. Music can be a huge mood changer. I think that's probably the thing that changes the mood in a space the fastest that I know of, is to have music ready to go thoughtfully, right? If it's during the day and you want peppy, like we're, conducting an orchestra kind of thing, or rocking out music, or calm down music, but that can take the person out of their loop. So there's many, many, many ways to do it, but those are a few.
I love that idea of something that came to mind. I don't have children, but I know plenty of people who do. And the idea of, oh, we need to plan for everything, right? It's in the diaper bag. If they're hungry, we need this. If they're cranky, we need this. We need games for the road trip, all of that. It's that same capability of saying, oh, I need to have some things planned. I need
Right.
to have some things ready to go that we can pivot to, or we can switch to, or we can swap in, or somebody else can come in and say, "Hey, in that bag over there is a jigsaw puzzle. Can you just do that?" And so approaching it in that same way feels like a valid life skill we keep using as we're caring for others.
Yeah, no, that's a great thing. Sometimes we talk about putting like a box together of their favorite things, right? Or with scents that they enjoy, or music that they know is soothing, to them or exciting to them. And activities that they're gonna like. I feel like for family caregivers in the home setting, it's sort of the most challenging, right? If you go live in an assisted living community, there's a huge calendar of events. People can be doing something different, at every hour almost. Certainly, you don't need that kind of a robust calendar at home, but many hours with unplanned activities is not going to be useful for a person with dementia. And then consequently, it's not going to be useful for the family caregiver. Television can be a big problem for people with Alzheimer's, a huge problem, especially depending on what they're watching. It can really be confusing for people to distinguish what they see on TV compared to what's happening in their real life. And it can bring up memories that can be upsetting, There's a
Interesting.
lot, yeah, there's a lot. So the default of like, don't do anything, just sit there, That's not helpful. It's too many hours. As people go through Alzheimer's, they're often relieved of or stripped of responsibility, right? They're not working anymore. Maybe they're not driving anymore. Maybe some of those people have fallen away in their circle. And it's just a lot of hours of boredom. And that will fall to the family caregiver usually to fill or deal with the consequences, right? So thinking about it a little bit in terms of planning, we're going to do one thing in the morning and one thing in the afternoon, or we're going to have this many outings a week, or we need to get out of the house and get fresh air, or engaging them in something you're doing and making that an activity, cooking, cleaning, what can they still do, right? And be useful and have a meaningful day. So there's a lot to think about.
I want to get a little bit more of a, not that all of this isn't very serious, but a little bit more of a serious topic that I think comes up for caregivers. You mentioned kind of respite and potentially at some point in time there's, a different living situation. And how many people have said, I'll never put my parent in a home. They made me promise I would never put them in a home. And we are living in kind of that moral construct of it makes me a bad person, it makes me a bad child. It makes me betray the person who gave me most. Well, all of those really heavy things. This must be something that you have come across as you're working with families or you're working just with people in your life who are going through this. What do you talk to people about when they're facing really impossible choices?
Yeah, there's so much in that too. You're bringing up so many important topics. So, I have a workshop called Give Up the Guilt for Family Caregivers. I have a workshop called Caregiver Promises You Can Keep. They're sort of like whole, there's a lot to say about each of these things for sure. This is one of the more common experiences, even in phrasing the question, put your person in a place. Is the way it is commonly described. So you're, right in step with the world in terms of how you're talking about that. But I would even question the phrasing and just there's so much stigma in that because if you have to put your person in a home, that is going to induce guilt, right? It's an automatically, you're automatically framing it like that's the worst choice, but I had no choice. I'm at the end of my rope with it. The reality is that family caregivers do it for as long as they can, given the circumstances that they have. That's the typical reality. And putting someone or arranging for a different living situation is usually seen as a last resort. In some way, that's, aligning with people's preferences. Most people do prefer to live at home as long as they possibly can. I think it's a little bit of a lost opportunity. It can be wonderful to live in a community for older adults, and this idea of everybody living independently, alone, isolated, if they're not driving, is not necessarily the best thing for everyone. So there's no given, right? It's sort of whatever is best for that individual in terms of their preferences, in terms of their care needs, in terms of their safety, in terms of their enrichment, right? So there's no right or wrong to me in terms of where somebody lives. In terms of the guilt, if you know you're thinking with your person to the extent possible about what is the best setting to meet their needs, I think that results in less guilt. It can be hard in families to have those conversations, and that can be from the point of view of the, say, adult child or grandchildren. And the older adult, and there's sometimes a lot of friction there. So we can work those through individually. There's always ways to talk about it or ways to let's try this. Or it's families where they don't talk about it. I feel like that it's worse because then the adult child is working through a process where they're getting more and more nervous, maybe about what they see. And they're like, that's it. I've made a decision. You're going to get home care. I'm taking your keys. I'm putting you in a different place to live. So it's when the families can talk together over time that I think it usually goes better, and then there are fewer feelings of guilt that result from that process.
And when you're lucky, you've got everybody on the same page because it's not necessarily us versus them, and there's only two opinions in the room, right? Like I might have one opinion and my sibling has a very different opinion, and we're kind of back channeling in different ways that doesn't progress the conversation. You just kind of mentioned the notion of, keeping an eye out for things and when somebody's starting to worry. Let's talk about what some of those warning signs are that's going to say it's time that we kind of bring it up with your doctor.
So that's about cognitive health, right?
Yeah.
So I think a warning sign again would be just paying more attention, right? So when you're visiting your person, to kind of tune in a little bit to anything that you're seeing that's amiss. If they were very organized and kind of always on top of housekeeping and they kept their house a certain way and it's different, it's in disarray, or there's things, oh, that doesn't seem like mom, right? She wouldn't have spoiled food in the fridge like this if something's going on, or that stack of mail, or unpaid bill notices. Those kinds of things can be indicators that someone's not really holding it together in the way that they were before. If they're you live far away or you live close, but they're asking you questions about things that you would think would be routine for them, about I got this call from somebody, or my, like something that just seems like, huh, that's weird. Is it just that one-off, or you're starting to notice, wait, no, she said the same thing last month, or there's another thing that's sort of gone, a little askew. So I would just start to monitor, and that's something that you can do more regularly. It might even come into driving habits, right? That can be something that is where you're going to first notice an issue. So when you're there, you're sort of looking at the car, are there dings there, unexpected things happening that are indicators of damage? Are there tickets? Are there stories like, this guy was cut me off, or can you believe, blah, blah, blah. These are indicators to say things are piling up and maybe need looking into. Problems with medication can be another area that it's like, oh, they're just not on top of it. That's one way of thinking. How are they functioning in their life? Just in their storytelling, as you're having conversations, you're like, they're repeating it and they're not catching. They're telling me the same exact way with the same wording in the same tone. There's no recognition of, we just talked about this. There's a few times in our conversation where you've been like, wait, and that shows you are cognitively intact. If you ask me the same, so I'm sort of always tuned into that level when I'm talking to people. So it's just paying attention to it a little bit more.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, those are some areas.
I think what I appreciated, two points there. One was the monitoring, and some of it is in the moment, and some of it is kind of clue finding in the environment that you can look out for. I hadn't thought about the, go check out the, you haven't seen the car in a little bit. Let's go check and see if there's new scrapes and scratches and dents. And when you ask them about it, what happens from there. But I think also the idea of like, oh, jotting it down, like whether you have to rely on your own memory or you take some notes around, how do you understand when it becomes a pattern? How do you understand when that unique thing that happened in this part of their life is, you wouldn't have necessarily drawn a conclusion about this other thing, but maybe as we start to see them come together, it's enough to say, oh, okay, let's talk about this.
Having a place to record all of these things is a really nice way to get organized about it and to relieve yourself from having to keep reliving and rehearsing and refreshing your own memory about when did they say this and what's that story again that's so, incriminating or worrying or whatever it might be. So having a place where you, as the family member or friend or, partner, whatever it is, can sort of download it from your own memory. So that could just be the notes app on your phone. It doesn't need to be fancy. You can have a Word document, you can have a journal, you can have a file where you're just throwing stuff in there. And having those systems can be super important so that when you do talk to the person, it's not a like, he said, she said, I don't have a problem with this. Yes, you do. You said, it's sort of more concrete when you're going to a doctor's office or an appointment. You can say, here's the pattern, and very quickly convey to that busy clinician what's going on. And I think having those practices can be helpful. It can also be contentious to bring them up with an older person who might feel defensive or worried about their someone who loves them, but someone taking over their decision making or someone recognizing areas where they're having trouble. So we talk a lot about content, right? But there's also just family dynamics and ways to have those conversations where you can align with the person more closely and attend to their emotional health and feelings and not make it so all about the content. So I just say to pay attention to how you bring it up. I'm worried about you. I've noticed. So a couple of I statements can be helpful. Do you worry about this at all? Is this something you're concerned about? What are you worried about? Let me help you with that. I'm happy to keep this, on a list so that we can ask the next time you have your doctor's appointment. Do you want to try to get an appointment sooner? No. Okay. We'll wait till your regular visit. That gives them control over the situation. You can say, I don't want to take this over, but I'm here to support you. We're going to figure this out. Like, there's so many ways to kind of attend to the person's emotional health and align with them, which in no matter what the content, that's going to be better than this. I think you should stop driving. No, I don't. I think you need to move. No, I don't. That's sort of the worst of it.
And you're putting it in a way that I truly relate, which is feels like an adult child with a parent kind of conversation. But sometimes there's the, oh, Both of my parents are around, and one's hiding for the other one. One's masking for the other one. One doesn't think it's a problem. One thinks it's a bigger problem than it is, right? We're also sometimes inserting ourselves in other people's marriages, right? In that kind of way of a dynamic, which is its own thorny issue sometimes.
Yeah, that's so true. And so it's like anything in a family or a relationship. It's ongoing conversation. Who gets to decide, right? We get to decide for ourselves, unless usually we're a danger to ourselves or others, and then there's someone else that's going to take over, or their opinions are going to become more of a priority. And those decisions can be really hard and painful, and it's not always super easy. But this is the work of it, and really these issues are being sorted out in millions and millions of families, really all over the world. And, now kind of backing it up a little bit. So this is my gerontology perspective. The demographics have changed so drastically just in the last century, right? So if we were born in the year 1900, about 100 years ago, life expectancy on average then was 47 years. The average person lives an additional 30 years in their lifespan compared to people just a century ago, one, two generations, three generations ago, right? So we're still getting used to how to do it. We've always cared for our own people. That's nothing new, but never for as long as we're caring for them now with the number of choices that we have, with the array of complexity that we have. So, in terms of how do you do it, we're still really figuring it out in terms of families, and it is happening mostly in family structures, these things. So there's no one right way for sure.
You're reminding me of a conversation I have with my father-in-law. So he's 87 and he's the youngest of 10, right? So think about that stretch of they do date back to the early 1900s. And he would talk about, in my day when I was younger, my parents, they were like, it's different in every other way, but his own lived experience that he's holding on to of what happens to the old people is very much rooted in something from the 30s. And so it's as with everything in this caregiving to aging parents journey, there is so much to be said about empathy being the most important thing that we can do that gets us to compassion for them and compassion for ourselves. And I'm always being reminded of that. I appreciate it. I want to talk about one more thing before we switch to the quicksand three, if that's okay, which is you kind of you know we you mentioned the notes app, which is like one of my favorites, the thing. It's probably the app on my phone I use the most. But like, can we talk about some systems, some tools, some resources that you think that an adult child who's kind of navigating through all this should know about or hang on to?
Yeah, good question. Hard to answer in some way. I think there's a lot of resources. So if it's cognitive related, Alzheimer's, dementia related, I think the general resources are the Alzheimer's Association, which is a fabulous resource. The Alzheimer's Foundation of America plays a similar role to the Alzheimer's Association, also a really highly respected organization. Those are kind of two that you should know about. Even though both of them have Alzheimer's in the title, they do help with other kinds of dementia as well. So you should know that. They have robust websites. They can help put you in touch with support groups in your area. You can just learn more by reading, in terms of what they offer. They have access to research and clinical trials that people might want to be associated with or, trying new interventions. So those are kind of the big ones there. I feel like Alzheimer's.gov is another site that's relatively newer in terms of the years, but they've added to that and it's more robust right now. The Area Agency on Aging system, which exists in almost every county of our country, is another just general system that you should know about. People can use Elder Care Locator, which they would find at eldercare.gov. To look up their Area Agency on Aging, you can search by zip code or town and state and find your Area Agency on Aging. So, tapping into that aging network of local resources is going to be just a general resource that people should know about. If that is hard or unclear, you can always just go to your town, and your senior center, your municipal agent can really help to direct you. So I think those are the general ones for dementia. There are also, though, disease-specific foundations. So Parkinson's Foundation, there's a Lewy Body Association, there's a frontotemporal dementia association or foundation, whatever their name is. There's sort of those as well. So, even though we think about the bigger ones, the Alzheimer's Association and so on, there's these more specific ones. Beyond that, there are so many resources depending on what the specific is. So maybe we'll leave it at the general rather than overwhelm people with a lot of specifics. But I'm a resource. I borrow my glasses. My organization is a resource. We have mainly worked with businesses and organizations and professionals, but we are starting to work more with family caregivers directly instead of through those other ways. So I can talk more about that if you'd like.
We'll go when we come back from the quick scan through. I want to go deeper into how people can learn more about you, Bar and Glasses, some other resources, and so that's great. So let's shift into that. And thank you for that. And I often forget, right? For the most part, probably in every city and town in America, there is some sort of municipal structure that's meant to design, even if it's at a county level, meant to design this support this work for everyone. And starting locally can also open up big doors for you. So the quicksand three, which I ask everyone, I want to start with the first one, which is, what's something you do when you've been procrastinating or avoiding something? What's something you do to get yourself going and initiate on that?
Right. That's such a great question. For me, as I think about, and I can be the procrastinator sometimes, so I speak from experience here with this one. I think it is two things. I put a visual reminder sort of in my way. So, putting that medication bottle, like where my toothbrush is. So I'm like, right, I've got to take that tomorrow morning because I only take it once a month, kind of thing. So putting a visual reminder, sometimes it's just a post-it note, right, to remind me to do something. And then it's the word just comes to mind. So I'll just do this one bit. It's really about breaking something down into smaller steps. So I'll just write this one email, or I'll just write this one section, or I'll just look up this one research study. And often then I can get engaged beyond that. That's how I do it.
Perfect. I love that. The next one is if skills and money and time and history and all sorts of factors were not a factor, what would be a job or a career you might have liked to try?
That's a fun one to think about. For me, it would be to be a travel photographer. I would love to be able to do that if money were no object.
I love that. Oh gosh.
Yeah.
I'm somebody who always had a camera growing up, and every time that we would travel or have a wedding or anything, like I was always a person taking pictures. And some of my travel, I put together albums of Japan and Hawaii and London and all these places. Some of those are like prized possessions for me. So I would love that as well. And then finally, what's a way that when life gets chaotic that you recharge or hit the reset button?
Photography, that's my hobby. And anything that involves the ocean, so being near the ocean and water just sort of feeds my soul. And I feel better when I can see a large body of water, even driving by, or from a plane or in any way, shape, or form, being near the water.
Well, I know you're kind of coastal area, coastal adjacent in Connecticut, and I grew up across the Sound in Long Island, and
Yeah.
when you explain to people like, oh no, I could just go to the water in 10 minutes and I'd be there, for a lot of people in the whole rest of the country, that's completely foreign. So I get that fully. I have so enjoyed having you here, and I clearly think that we could have talked for another 4 hours. But I want to help people understand more about how to learn more about you and your expertise and your services. What can you share?
Thank you for the opportunity. It's been really my pleasure to talk with you. You've got great questions. You're really, I think, doing a service to all of your listeners as you are learning about things yourself to be sharing with other people. So you ask great questions, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
As far as Bar My Glasses, we do a few things. We largely work with businesses and organizations at this point. So if any of your listeners need a speaker for anything, I do lots and lots of workshops. I probably have 50 different topics in the catalog right now, developed over 35 years as a gerontologist, almost 20 years as a dementia educator. So if people are looking for a speaker That would be a workshop, a conference presentation, whatever, a keynote, whatever it might be. I'm really happy to do that. I can offer continuing education credits for professionals if you need that or not. Can speak to your referral sources or your constituents, your customers, your residents, your patients, your clients, whatever it might be. So education is one way that we connect. The second way we connect with organizations is through something we call scalable learning solutions. And for this, it's often a more detailed project where we're working to meet some business need. So you talked about your own life experience, for instance, of not having kids. In my world, or in the world of a client of mine, they call that a solo ager, right? People are aging independently by choice or by circumstance. So we work with that organization to revamp a program that they have and created a 6-week curriculum to talk about how do you face the world as an aging person when you think you're going to be doing that solo. So that for me is a scalable learning solution. It's to design the curriculum, to test it, to modify it, to create a train the trainer for that organization, and then they'll have that as a flagship program of their organization. So anything scalable like that, we created a module for call center staff at a large insurance company to be able to provide better customer service for older people calling in. That's a scalable learning solution for us because it's now offered across their company in 5 states out west. So things like that. We did 5 years worth of work with AARP to design curriculum to help transform attitudes about aging. And then we tested it and evaluated it as well. So that's kind of the third area. So training, scalable learning solutions, and evaluation services are something else that we do a lot of with organizations. So that's what we're doing right now. I think I would just add that we are trying to move into the area of B2C, so business going right to consumers or clients more into the future. To translate some of this content that I've developed over many decades and many years, to be more accessible and usable for consumers. So that's my challenge coming up to make some of that available via e-learning and hybrid formats where they can get some on their own and then access some time with me as a professional to talk through the example. So that's in the future. If people want to think about that or sponsor that with me, I'm very, very excited about doing that. And I think I would probably just mention one last thing, and that is something called WHOOP, which is a cool word. It's an acronym, but WHOOP stands for Wish, Outcome, Obstacle, Plan. And it is a 4-step evidence-based process to help people fulfill their wishes. And Borrow My Glasses was really lucky to collaborate with Yale University to do a study funded by the National Institute on Aging to test the feasibility of WHOOP with dementia caregivers. And it's highly feasible. So we are offering WHOOP groups for caregivers who want to learn the strategy. And they can do that in just 3 weeks. So it's usually 3 weeks in a row for an hour at a time right now. And happy to offer WHOOP groups with people as well. So that's kind of another way we're getting involved with caregivers directly.
Can
So
you
lots.
talk a little bit more about wish, outcome, obstacle, plan, and doing this does what we hope for dementia caregivers?
It helps them to figure out where they have control and then how to achieve their wishes. So wish is sort of the first step there. And we would have people zone in on wishes or goals or needs that they have in their life. It could be directly related to caregiving or not. When we started talking, you or some at some point you were saying to have more patience, right? To get less frustrated. That could be your wish. So it could relate to feelings, or it could be your wish is something more tangible, to have a conversation with someone, to declutter a room, to get information, whatever it would be. So the wish can be your own. And then your outcome would be what would be the experience if you fulfilled that wish? We zone in on that. The next letter is obstacle. So what is your internal obstacle getting in your way? Not like you wish your brother did more, you can wish that, but it's really looking within, right? What is your internal obstacle? Because again, that's where you have control. And then once you know that, what is your plan to overcome that obstacle to fulfill your wish and experience your outcome? So it's pretty powerful.
It feels very powerful, especially when I think about caregiving, which definitely can make you feel like you are, as much as you are responsible for getting the car to move forward, you're not in the driver's seat, right? And you don't necessarily get to choose where your time, money, and energy is spent. And there's so many other factors that are behind the situation and what might feel like a lack of choice going forward. And just putting that in such empowering language to say, no, you are allowed to have a wish. Let's explore that. Let's look internally for how you're getting in your own way. You can blame your brother, you can blame everything else, but let's talk about internally what you're doing to get yourself in not moving forward to that, and then owning a plan. I love this model, and I hope to explore that with you.
Yeah, well, you're invited to a Whoop group. Happy to have you, and
Thank
happy
you.
to have anyone that, if they go to our website, borrowmyglasses.com, Whoop is something that they'll see there under featured education. And so just clicking on that will give you the dates. We have Whoop groups starting almost once a month. We're skipping 1 month in October because of other commitments, but for the rest of this year. So and ongoing if we can, keep it going. We also are likely to be doing more research to test other aspects of Whoop and do some facilitator training. So I know some of your listeners are going to be family caregivers and just need it for their own life to sign up. Some might be professionals wanting to bring Whoop to their group, whatever it might be. So happy to accommodate both of those. So if people are interested, they can, what's the best thing? They can go on our website, sign up for our mail list. That would be one thing. Borrow my glasses. I'm new on Instagram. It's challenging for me. This is not my comfort zone, but I'm really trying. So we're on Instagram now. And LinkedIn, it's just Donna Fettis, my name on LinkedIn.
Great.
Facebook, less so, but trying to do these things. It's so you can find us. It's our website's out there.
And I will have all of that information in the show notes. So if you're driving while listening to this, you don't have to pull over. You get it when you're safely home. Donna, thank you so much. This was such a great conversation, and I'm so pleased to have brought you to this world of Surfing the Quicksand audience. And I know that you're going to be changing lives just as you already do every day.
Thank you for having me. This is my life's work. I really love what I get to do. So I appreciate being here and your wonderful questions and happy to talk anytime and good luck to you in your own journey.
Thank you.
Okay.
As always, I feel like I could speak another 4 hours with a wonderful guest, and I'm really grateful that I had this opportunity to have rich conversations with people who are experts in their field, who have such passion about impacting the lives of so many, whether they're professionals in this space or they're just the family caregiver kind of on that front line of dealing with issues in the home and in their families that impact us every day. I hope you got a lot out of that conversation with Donna, and you can head over to Borrow My Glasses and learn more about the kinds of services and the kinds of programmings that she offers. I love the idea of this Whoop methodology, and I can't wait to do it myself. I really believe in kind of that empowerment that she was speaking to, and I hope that you'll check that out yourself. It sounds like the kinds of things that can really, again, when we have a life that so little is in our control, get a little bit more back. If you are someone who's in a situation where you can bring somebody, a speaker, into your organization that can help educate people on what's going on and awareness and context about aging and longevity and dementia, I hope that you'll reach out to her because, as you can tell, she's a passionate and dynamic speaker. And I think everybody's going to walk away with value, just like I hope you did today. Thanks so much.